Welcome to the Command Line Podcast for June 30th, 2010. I'm your host, Thomas Command Line Gideon, a self-proclaimed hacker, eccentric, and hacktivist. This is my show about the practice and profession of programming, drawing on well over a decade of professional experience and a lifetime spent hacking, the intersection of technology with society and public policy, and anything else clever, elegant, or funny that catches my mind as a diehard technology geek. This episode is a feature cast. In it, I have the audio that I got from Cory Doctorow's talk at the June Copy Night at the start of this past week. Due to the length of the feature, there's not going to be any new Hacker Word of the Week this week, and also because of unforeseen circumstances, it took me 2 hours to commute home this evening, and so I'm in a bit of a rush. I will put off the listener feedback that I was going to go over and share until the next feature cast next week. With regards to the audio for the talk, I do want to warn you, as I usually do, that the quality in this case is pretty good, except for a little bit of clipping. Hopefully, again, you'll find the content compelling enough to overlook that. And I have to give out a very, very special thanks to Chooch, a good friend of mine, fellow podcaster, musician with Phil Rossi and The Awakening. And he and his lovely wife do the Into the Blender podcast, and he totally saved my bacon in pulling together the audio that I'm going to share with you. If it wasn't for him, I wouldn't have anything to show for after the fact, other than the embedded video that I posted and the whole experience of setting everything up with Cory, but I wouldn't be able to bring Cory's talk, which I think is very dynamic and very important, to share with you, many of whom didn't have the opportunity to be there. So thank you so much, Chooch. I know I said that I would have some further remarks on the 5th anniversary of the podcast, and I actually realized that I said everything that I needed to say in the blog post and in last week's feature. So if you missed that, go ahead and check those out. I'm still very happy to have made it this far, and again, looking forward to at least another 5 more years doing the podcast.
Good evening. I'd like you all to ask yourself a question briefly. If you were stuck on a desert island, could only bring one website with you, what would it be? I personally would bring boingboing.net. I think it's such a great composite of culture, of technology, the intellectual property, and of politics. And that's why I'm so pleased this evening to welcome you to the New America Foundation for a conversation with Boing Boing's co-editors, Cory Doctorow. My name is James Losey, and I work here with the New America Foundation. We are a nonpartisan, nonprofit think tank. We have 15 different programs and initiatives, from healthcare to media, from education to foreign policy, and we invest in new ideas and new thinkers to address the next generation of challenges facing the United States. I work with the Open Technology Initiative, the technology arm here at the foundation, a tech tank within the think tank, if you will. The Open Technology Initiative formulates policy and regulatory reforms to support open architectures and open source innovations and facilitates the development and implementation of open technologies and communications networks. And it doesn't take much to find a clear example that the internet is not as open as it could be. I think of all of us here that try to watch the World Cup online, we have found often the web stream is blocked. The World Cup is being hailed as the largest web event in history, with the FIFA website at peak receiving 12 million hits not daily, not hourly, but each minute. Yet viewing the World Cup can be blocked by region and accessible only to residents of one country or another, or behind walls created by special deals a content provider like ESPN may have made with the internet service provider. Now, the internet is hailed as a democratizing force, and countries like China, Iran, and Burma are criticized for online censorship, blocking websites like Facebook or otherwise restricting access. Earlier this year, Secretary of State Hillary Clinton said that new technology does not take sides. Yet ironically, American web users are faced with restricted access to websites here at home to watch a sporting event shared by the world. These actions beg the question, what are the levers that drive internet enclosures and restricted access? What are the technologies and tools used to restrict access at the expense of users and at the cost of freedom? In addition to being editor at Boing Boing, co-founder of the UK Open Rights Group, and award-winning science fiction author, Cory Doctorow is vocal on copyright issues and the effects of copyright on internet freedom. While I'll let my co-host give a more proper introduction, Cory helps shine lights on some of these levers where the overreach of intellectual property has impacts the great democratizing aspects of the internet, such as closed-door meetings on international copyright treaties to countries proposing laws that terminate internet connections after 3 copyright violations without proof. The conversation this evening is hosted by 2 other organizations, Public Knowledge and Copyright DC. And before we bring Cory up, I'd like to give both Gigi Sohn of Public Knowledge and Tom Gideon of Copyright DC both an opportunity to say a few words. Public Knowledge has been an ally with the Open Technology Initiative on a number of DC telecom policy battles, and has been defending a wide portfolio of digital rights since its founding in 2001. Public Knowledge has fought to protect the open internet, as well as work to ensure that copyright and intellectual property policies balance incentives to creators, as well as public benefits to the free flow of information and ideas. Please welcome Gigi Sohn. Gigi Sohn, co-founder and president of Public Knowledge.
Thank you, James, and welcome, everybody. It's great to see. I think the last copy night I went to was around our conference room table in our old space up on Connecticut Avenue, and there were like 15 of us eating pizza. So this is a marked improvement. No insult to the other people who are eating pizza with me, but this is really wonderful, and I think copy night is a terrific event. I am absolutely honored on behalf of the board and staff of Public Knowledge to co-host this event with Cory Doctorow, who I consider not only a colleague but a friend. Cory is, I would say, at this point, the single most influential voice on copyright and copyright policy, certainly in this country, probably in the world. I mean, he doesn't live in this country, but still, he's, you know, enormously influential in that regard. Besides that, he's an overall nice guy and very natty dresser, so as you will see. So, James, thanks for explaining who Public Knowledge is. If you don't know who we are a public interest advocacy organization that seeks to defend your digital rights on broadband policy issues and also copyright issues. But thanks to Cory, we are now probably even more famous as one of the ASCAP 3. I don't know if people must know about this, right? So ASCAP decided that they were going to raise money and say that Public Knowledge, Creative Commons, and EFF were, you know, working to destroy copyright and wanted everybody to have free music. So please give $1. Or $5 to defend your rights. So what has landed up happening, and again, Boing Boing was the one that publicized this to everybody, is that people have been quitting ASCAP left and right. I mean, it's one thing to beat up on Public Knowledge and EFF, but Creative Commons, I mean, cut me a break, right? And they've been giving money. We've been getting some money as a result. So I did actually call up ASCAP's lobbyist, and I said, I don't really know why you decide to beat the crap out of us, but just know it doesn't really work, and it actually hurts you. So, as James said, Public Knowledge is really working hard to bring balance back to copyright. And even though we have a lot of friends in the administration, they are so freaked out about the lobbying strength of the content industry that it is really, really a chore. And there are 2 things that are really on our plate that are very important. And I really would urge you, please join our mailing list, join in our action alerts. The first is the Anti-Counterfeiting Trade Agreement, which most people know would essentially export all the rights of copyright without any of the fair uses of, limitation exception of copyright. We have an action alert right now. We really, to the White House, we want to tell the Obama administration that this trade agreement sucks. So please, just go on our website. It's right on the front page there. The second thing, some of you may have heard that this intellectual property enforcement coordinator, whose formation we opposed by Congress last year, but our corporate friends bowed out, so we got this bill, has said, among other things, that they are going to look at all the copyright enforcement laws and figure out how they can strengthen them. And I will tell you, that is going to include looking at the Digital Millennium Copyright Act. And while a lot of us don't like the DMCA, they want to go after the parts that we do like. In other words, the parts that protect internet service providers and online service providers like Google and Yahoo and others from liability if they take down copyright infringing works. So we may have yet another battle royale on hand. So stay tuned. There's a lot going on in this space, and I'm looking forward to hearing Corey talk more about how copyright affects democracy, and not in a good way. So good night, everybody, and it's a pleasure to be here.
Thank you, Gigi. I have one other co-host tonight, Thomas Gideon of Copy Night DC. They were kind enough to share the greater community of folks that just quite like talking about copyright. So please welcome Tom Gideon.
I want to thank New America and Public Knowledge for the space in video streaming and for the refreshments in the back there, respectively. All of this is a bit out of ordinary for Copy Night. Usually Copy Night is a monthly gathering of folks interested in balanced copyright, discussing the topic in an informal setting over drinks. Well, we have those. Feel free to visit copynight.org for more information on the next regular meeting and for details on Copy Nights in other locations. It is worldwide. Here in DC, Copy Night brings together a distinct intersection of people from folks at public interest organizations like Public Knowledge to librarians, from Hill staffers to musicians, writers, and filmmakers. This month, we have a guest who stands out even for this usually rather diverse crowd, one who I think you'll agree would have drawn enough people to completely overwhelm our regular, more casual discussion, hence the special venue and arrangements. In the debate over balanced copyright, Cory Doctorow is a singular figure. He is an activist, having worked with the EFF and helping to, as previously noted, found the Open Rights Group in the UK. He continues to work as an activist, writing articles and essays on a range of topics, almost always with technology and creative endeavor as common threads. He also speaks at a wide variety of events, like this one, to audiences with equally diverse interests. What makes Cory's voice in this debate uncommon is that he has a foot in two worlds. Cory has a stake in the traditional publishing world. He's worked hard to become a well-established and best-selling author, with a strong relationship with his publisher, Tor. He has been able to balance that traditional model of book sales with increasingly bold experiments in freely sharing his works, allowing and encouraging creative, derivative, non-commercial uses. Cory challenges our expectations of how these two worlds interact. It is always a pleasure to hear how the synthesis of the two inspires his thinking. It's my pleasure to introduce him to share the latest evolution of his thinking on the subject of copyright. Cory Doctorow.
Thank you very much. So thank you to Public Knowledge and New America and Copy Night, and especially Thomas, who's really he's got a full-time job and still managed to put this together. This is really, in many ways, his baby. So thank you all for coming tonight. So I have a usual copyright stump speech I do. I go all over the world and I give it, and I reify creativity. I talk about how important it is and how creativity isn't necessarily aligned with copyright anymore, and how we need to better serve our culture by unlocking it and letting people share it. And I've got lots of cute aphorisms like, it's not culture if you don't let people talk about it, that's a secret, and so on. And then I talk about how dumb DRM is and it doesn't work. And I say things like, to publishers who think that DRM can work to lock up books, I say, behold the typist. And I talk about how there are better business models, and I give my books away, and they're still New York Times bestsellers, and we had 90,000 hardcovers the last one, and so on. So I've been doing that for about 10 years now. And after 10 years, I've come to realize that at the end of the day, it's all a little parochial. What I mean by parochial is best epitomized by a story about a speech that the head of the British Phonographic Institute, which is like the RIA in the UK, I live in England, gave several years ago. And a friend of mine and I went to see him. And he gave this talk all about how they were reacting to technological change. And he finished it off with this remarkable thing. He said, you know, you people from all you other industries, you think that we're crazy because we sue our fans and we're not adapting fast enough. You just wait. Like my parents going, you just wait until you've got kids like you, you know. You just wait, because the 3D printer is coming. And when the 3D printer arrives, all of you who depend on trademark and patent, you're going to be exactly where we are, and you will handle it with no more grace than we do. And on the way out, my friend said, you know, that's pretty amazing, right? Someone from the record industry talking about 3D printing, that's kind of like technologically savvy. How interesting. I said, yeah, it's true, but you know, he thinks the major impact of the 3D printer is going to be trademark infringement. I mean, this is like looking at the railroad and going, all you people who sew oat bags for horses, you're all out of work in 5 years. I mean, it's undoubtedly true, but this was not the major impact of the railroad. So that's what I mean when I say it's all a little parochial to talk about copyright and to restrict the discussion to a discussion about culture and creativity. As important as culture and creativity are, the major problem of the copyright wars isn't what they're doing to culture. It's what they're doing to every other part of human endeavor, from civic engagement to education to family life. So let's look at the copyright problem, the internet problem, from the entertainment industry's perspective. Let's look at what they've told us they want to fix. So first of all, the problem is that anyone can use the internet, even bad guys. There's no licensing regime. People who are convicted of infringing can go on using it. If you block one person out in one IP address, they pop up another. You're playing whack-a-mole forever. And part of that is because IP addresses don't correspond to individual users, but to groups of users, sometimes households, sometimes entire networks of people hide behind a single IP address. A certain degree of anonymity comes for free for all users. The internet wasn't designed with identity in mind, and affirmatively identifying people by their network transactions with you is hard and sometimes impossible, depending on the degree of evidence that you need to provide. If you're really, you know, pissed off at someone for something they did, and you really want to prove to a nicey that it was this person using this network connection, it can be very hard indeed. Geocoding is really inaccurate and it's trivial to defeat. You know, I don't know about you, but I these days no longer use public internet connections without going through a proxy. I use iPredator in Sweden. It's run by the same people who put together the Pirate Bay, who say whatever you want about them, are very good at IT. And they run an SSL proxy that you can subscribe to for €5 a month for as much traffic as you want. All my traffic goes through there because there are all kinds of creep sniffing networks. But, you know, as a consequence, every now and again, I'll do a Google search and all my results come back in Swedish. It's really hard if someone doesn't want you to know where they are. It's really hard to figure out where they are using IP addresses. Geocoding is easy when it's non-adversarial. You know, if I want my phone to know where I am so it can pick up the local time zone and weather when I get off the plane, that's easy. But it's also easy to just hop on the Tor network using my Android phone, and it's impossible to figure out where I am for some values of impossible by where I'm coming from. Endpoints are user configurable. That's a major problem for the entertainment industry. I can change the software on my computer without your permission, and I can access your network service with any software I want. It doesn't have to be just an approved piece of software. And this is really a problem in respect of the idea of streaming. So we make this strange non-technical distinction between streaming and downloading. And we pretend that streaming is a way for me to show you a creative work on the internet without allowing you to make a copy of it. As though there's like a cunning arrangement of mirrors that I'm using to direct the video to you, but no bits are actually traversing the wire and landing on your computer. Really, all the difference between a stream and a download is, at the end of the day, is that if I send you a stream, I believe that I'm sending it to a piece of software that doesn't save it. And if I send you a download, I believe I'm sending it to a piece of software that does. But there's not really any particular technical challenge in writing a piece of software that pretends that it's throwing away the bits and then doesn't. Lots of people do it. It's pretty trivial. And it makes the whole idea of being able to show someone something over the internet without giving them a copy of it into the technical lie that it is. It really makes it, streaming into the phlogiston of the 21st century, this thing that we all behave as though it's there and make policy around and kind of go on pretending that it's there, but actually, you know, not only doesn't exist, but doesn't exist in this very spectacular way that makes all the assumptions about it completely broken and wrong. Another big problem in respect of the way the network works is that there are many places on the network where you can host content. There's not just like the one repository or the 500 TV channels. Remember when we thought a 500 channel universe would be big? You know, imagine if we had the 500 website internet, how impoverished that would be. You know, instead, we've got the multi-billion channel internet, and there's not just one place you go to figure out whether or not someone's infringing on your copyright. There's lots and lots of places, and they don't have any duty whatsoever to make sure that the thing that their users have put up doesn't infringe on copyright. No, if you want to get something removed from the internet, you have a burden to figure out where it's being hosted, figure out who hosts it, and send them a notice telling them to take it down. Now, as as Gigi hinted at before, this is not entirely a terrible thing. You know, the content creators, content rights holders do get a little bit of a bonus because they don't have to prove anything. They just have to send the notice. So normally if you wanted to censor something, you'd be expected to rise to some burden of proof as opposed to, you know, I cross my heart and swear that infringes copyright. Please make it disappear off the internet. But still, it's a pretty substantial burden to have to look at all these websites and figure out which ones infringe your copyright and then go back the next day to see if a different user has put it up or put it up under another name. And moreover, even in situations where you can kind of strong arm network providers into blocking off parts of the internet, and we're seeing that more and more on campuses and in corporations and so on, it's really easy to root around them. You know, anyone who's ever operated a library terminal or a school terminal knows that, you know, your average 12-year-old is pretty good at getting around the mandatory censorware that the Communications Decency Act puts around all of our publicly funded networks. So the interesting thing for me, and really the crux of the talk tonight, is how many of those problems that I've just described overlap with the problems that repressive governments in countries like Syria and China have with the internet. How the agenda of fixing those problems is nearly identical between our entertainment industry and some of the worst governments, most repressive governments in the world. And this is not a bunch of small problems that can be easily adapted to. These are non-negotiable bugs as far as the entertainment industry is constituted today. As presently constituted, the entertainment industry cannot peacefully coexist with a network that has these characteristics. So imagine if the entertainment industry got what it wanted. Imagine if they actually managed to solve these problems. What would the internet look like? Well, first of all, you'd have to affirmatively identify every end user, and you'd need permission to use the net. And you know, the rhetorical trick to listen for if you want to find someone who's pitching this is they'll say things like, well, you can't get on the highway until you have a driver's license. Why should you be allowed on the information superhighway without an internet license? And, you know, I've heard this in any number of policy circles. It's the place where the information superhighway metaphor has gone to die, right? It's the last place where we still hear people talking about the information superhighway. Well, what would it mean if every user was affirmatively identified? Well, for one thing, it would be very easy for news organizations or entertainment companies to discriminate against people based on where they are. Certainly in an advertising-supported internet, it would be very easy to block off poor people as not being interesting to your advertisers. So you just sort of shut them off, as you wouldn't have to go on providing free email accounts or hosting or access to streams because their demographic is uninteresting to your advertisers. More broadly, though, this opens up a whole can of worms for all kinds of discrimination on a national and regional level about what news you can see and who gets access to it. So if you want to see the kind of code for this, you'll hear people from the entertainment industry sometimes say, well, we've managed to solve child pornography with censor walls. Look at all the countries that are using censor walls to solve child pornography. There's Canada, there's the United Kingdom, there's, you know, all these other Western liberal democracies, you know, Australia's doing it and so on. And if we can solve the child pornography problem with a censor wall, why can't we solve the copyright infringement problem with a censor wall? Well, first of all, the child pornography problem has not been remotely solved with censor walls in any of those countries. In fact, the people who built the censor wall for Australia, the very controversial censor wall for Australia, whenever the minister who's paying them to build it gets up and says, and this will solve child pornography, hurriedly issue a statement that says, no, it won't. No, 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 that's not what we're doing. What we'll do is stop you from accidentally clicking a link and seeing child pornography. But if you're actually looking for child pornography, this totally won't work. But nobody seems to listen to those people. Indeed, last Christmas, a great champion of freedom, Bono Vox from U2, wrote an editorial in the New York Times where, among other things, he said, you know, China's figured out how to suppress dissident information on its network using network blocks. Why can't we do the same thing for copyright infringement? Now, Bono, we know you love freedom. We just wish you'd share. But the factual matter is that China has completely failed to block access to information that's dissident and harmful to its interests. That, you know, an all-powerful totalitarian state where, if you believe Falun Gong, dissidents are put in prison and have their organs harvested for party members, is still not technically capable of blocking off sections of the internet. But you will often hear people say, well, look at all these functional censor walls. Why can't we just build a censor wall for copyright infringement? Of course, there's another problem with copyright infringement and censor walls, is that it's moderately tractable to say, well, there's a whole realm of things that we can all point to and agree are child pornography, but there's a much larger realm of things that we can't point to and say whether or not it's copyright infringement unless you're a fully impaneled Supreme Court with a long time to deliberate after hearing the facts from all parties. And so figuring out what is and isn't a copyright infringement is not something that anyone has ever really built a microcontroller or a piece of software to do. I mean, if we could automate that, we'd have solved AI, we'd have gone through the singularity, we'd all be uploading our consciousness today. Another fix for the network would be that you could build, you would redesign the endpoints, you'd redesign the nodes so that you couldn't install any old software on your computer, just approved code. And this would solve the streaming problem. It would make it possible to send someone a piece of content, a selection of bits, and know to some nicety that when the bits arrived, they would then be discarded. They wouldn't be stored to some long-term storage medium. And we've got lots of proposals for this. We've heard them before. In the US, there was something called the broadcast flag. And the idea of the broadcast flag was that we would extend the realm of copyright, which controls things like the display and performance and adaptation of creative works, into what I sometimes think of as device right. And this is the right to specify which devices can and can't display a copyrighted work. This is really unusual for copyright. We've never really had that idea that it's kind of, you know, you might think of it as analogous to an author telling you whose bookcase you can put his books on. You know, you must buy them from IKEA and you may not buy them from Walmart or vice versa. And in the US context, the idea was that the FCC would become device czars for America, that if you wanted to build something that could connect to a digital television or a component that would live inside a device that could connect to a digital television, which to some approximation is everything, right? It's your phone, it's your PC, it's hard drives, it's video cards, it's network interfaces. You would first come to the FCC and demonstrate, among other things, that it would resist end user modification, that users wouldn't be able to change the way that it was configured in a way that was antithetical to the interests of the entertainment industry. Now, this is bad on many scores. For one thing, it's a kind of death sentence for free and open source software. Free and open source software is predicated on the idea that end users should and could modify their own tools. It's that there is no such thing as a meaningful free and open source software ecosystem in which you need a license to modify or permission from the state or from an industrial cartel to modify code, that we might as well kiss all of the innovation that we've had as a result of free and open source software goodbye. But there's another problem with this, and I call it the exploding spaceship problem. So I'm a science fiction writer. I go to science fiction movies mostly because it really hacks me off that those guys get paid so much more money than I do, and I don't think their works are nearly as good as the literary stuff I like. And one of the motifs of cinematic science fiction that really makes me crazy is the exploding spaceship button. You've all seen it. Everything's going fine on the deck of the Space Navy's bridge, and then someone's elbow slips and they hit the button that begins a plummy countdown from 10 to 0 in an English voice that sounds a little like Margaret Thatcher after speech therapy, and it counts down towards the destruction of the ship, and there doesn't seem to be any way to turn it off. And every time I see the self-destructing spaceship, I think to myself, I'm no aerospace engineer, but I think this would be a better spaceship if it wasn't designed to explode. And I'm not a security engineer, but I'm inclined to think that designing devices that are intentionally created such that remote policy can be set on them and enforced without their owner's knowledge or consent, even when it's antithetical to the owner's wishes or interests, is a bad idea. It's a bad idea on its face, not because people will use it to steal content or not use it to steal content, because everything we worry about on the internet, theft of your credit card numbers, access to, you know, the pictures of your kids in the bath, people snooping over your shoulder and reading your private email, theft of your trade secrets, all of that stuff, you have an open door to it. As soon as you create a mechanism, as soon as the device is designed to allow people to set policy on it and control it without your knowledge and against your interests, then anyone who figures out how to hijack that capability essentially can completely control your digital life. And I used to marvel at the perfect idiocy of someone who had prognosticated a future in which we built self-destructing spaceships, but we have arrived at the self-destructing spaceship world, right? We are now routinely building devices, and I'm hard-pressed to find a networked mobile device that doesn't have a self-destructing spaceship component. I mean, even, you know, my beloved Android phone, it turns out as of yesterday, we now know that Google can remove applications from it. And I'm glad that Google was able to remove some harmful and malicious applications. But we have to rely on the idea that we've loaded a gun and put it on the mantle, and that no one's going to fire it by Act 3. You know, this violates Chekhov's law of narrative, you know? having created an entire ecosystem of devices that have the capability to be remotely activated and controlled against their owner's wishes, we will be completely out of order if we complain when it turns out that these devices are being used to violate their owner's wishes. In fact, you know, we get hung up on devices. We start to think about them in terms of their daily characteristics. You know, every year you get a new generation of phones. I can write for you next year's either HTC Android or iPhone press release. It will go like this. Today, HTC or Apple released a new iteration of its phone. It's about 10% skinnier. The battery lasts about 20% longer. It has about twice as much memory. It costs about 30% more than the last one did and comes with an even more abusive mobile phone contract, right? I mean, that for probably the next 10 years, I mean, that's more or less what the press release is going to look like, because the devices aren't the important thing. The device will be in your pocket this week, and it'll be in a landfill in 8 months. The important thing to pay attention to here is not the device, because the device is just like a tendril being extruded into the physical realm by this huge kind of extra-dimensional entity that is the ecosystem of policy, technology, business, and law that controls it. And, you know, as H.P. Lovecraft taught us, it's not the tendril that matters, it's the elder god that's pushing it through into our reality. And that's what we need to be paying attention to. We are seeing this attack on user modifiability and this idea that devices shouldn't be responsive to their users' desires from all corners. The BBC has just gotten permission from its regulator to add DRM to its terrestrial broadcasts. We're seeing this in every kind of cable box and so on, and also in all the mobile devices and increasingly in our operating systems. So what does this mean? Well, it means that for one thing, only big companies would be impedance matched with regulators to figure out how to get their devices into and their components into devices. You know, your average entrepreneur who's figured out something cool and interesting to do would almost certainly be doing something that gored someone's ox. And as soon as you create an office of device control, you invite people to come forward with characteristics of device that must be banned in the field. We recently got the conclusions of Victoria Espinel, the new IP czar. But before she came to her conclusion, she opened it up for comments. And one of the most extraordinary sets of comments filed in her proceeding was from the Motion Picture Association of America. Among other things, they said that people should be encouraged to load software on their computer that would detect copyright infringement and delete it automatically. And they said people will do this voluntarily because they already do it to fight spyware. And first of all, again, spyware is a lot easier to point your finger at and all agree that this is spyware than copyright infringement. But let's really unpack what they're saying. They're saying they're advocating that we should all have code running on our computers that looks at every one of our files under the control of some remote party and decides which ones we're allowed to have and which ones we aren't. And if we're not allowed to have some of those files, it deletes them. I mean, this already works very poorly for antivirus software. There was just a major kerfuffle when McAfee bricked a lot of people's computers by deleting vital parts of the operating system because they mistook it for a virus. As soon as you expand the range of things that this hunter-killer stuff is supposed to get rid of, it's not just going to be bad news for us because it'll be misused by malicious people who use it to go after your dissident information or whatever. It's going to be bad news because it's going to be nuking vital parts of your operating system and rendering pieces of our information infrastructure inoperable on a daily basis. It'll be very hard to figure out what's going on. So one other fix to the network that we could expect to see if the copyright wars go the wrong way is that content hosting would be based on approval, that you could only put material online if it were first examined by someone who is competent to decide whether or not it infringed on copyright, and only then would it go online. And in fact, this is what Viacom has asked a court to make Google do. Now, that we just had a first round where the court told Viacom that that's not what Google needs to do. They vowed to appeal it, and Viacom basically said that for all 29 hours per minute of video being uploaded to YouTube, it should all be reviewed by a copyright lawyer to make sure that it doesn't infringe copyright. Well, I'm pretty sure that that exceeds the number of copyright lawyer hours remaining between now and the heat death of the universe, right? There aren't enough copyright lawyers extant. I mean, yes, this would be full employment for a trade that otherwise is desperately lacking it, but there just aren't enough copyright lawyers to do it. But if there were, what it would do is radically remake the landscape of what kind of content could be hosted online, because a copyright lawyer charges between $200 and $500 an hour to make that kind of decision. And most of the stuff that people put on YouTube or Twitter or Blogger or any of the other places where we get to host our own material, most of that stuff does not rise to the bar of being worth paying $500 an hour for someone to look at and make a decision about. Certainly something like WikiLeaks would never exist in that universe. You wouldn't find anywhere where you could host your anonymous videos of cops beating up G20 protesters. Establishing a website would become a complex and expensive process that would involve getting your ISP's lawyers to sign off on your content after you'd provided them with indemnity. And that's certainly something that no kid or community group would be able to achieve. You know, there's a reason that kids, political action groups, neighborhood associations, and so on don't have their own cable TV show. This is just too high a bar for them to traverse. They don't have an institution that can go and make deals with their local cable operator to put the Timmy's Little League team show online. But you know who it's not too high a bar to hurdle? People who already make cable TV shows. If you're that institution, this is normal. It's in fact irresponsible to say, well, you know, you shouldn't have to meet that very high burden to make material available to the public. That just sounds like a normal and natural restriction. It's something you do every day. You've got an entire building full of lawyers and administrative people who do nothing but process the legalities around making sure that nothing goes on the television that hasn't been first vetted for infringement and other problems that you might get into with the FCC. So other fixes that we might see to the network. Well, it would be very hard to figure out how to stop people from changing their location by going through a proxy. It's really woven into the fabric of the network, the idea that traffic can be routed through some host other than your own. So it would take a major re-architecting of the internet to get there. And, you know, all the silly season talk about kill switches be damned. I don't think we're going to have that happen. But one thing we are seeing is that in lots of realms where it's very hard to technically control something, the second best recourse is to simply raise the penalties for misuse to the point where it just scares everybody off. And so, you know, we're already getting this in the tool universe, where anyone who makes a general purpose networking tool that can be used to share a lot of content very quickly and with very little friction, if you go to a venture capitalist, you'll be told, go home, we're not really interested in getting sued into the ground, because anything that looks more or less like a file sharing network kind of disappears very quickly from the internet, regardless of what's on it or how many people use it for things that have nothing to do with copyright infringement. And we're now seeing these liability regimes extend to people who reroute traffic in other areas. So in Germany, they've started punishing people who run proxies that child pornography gets routed through. At the Electronic Frontier Foundation, we used to say that there are four horsemen of the apocalypse, four universal excuses for locking down the internet: child pornography, terrorists, the mafia, and pirates. And if you just sort of shout one of those words out very quickly while waving your hands, you can generally get any kind of censorious law passed. And certainly we've seen that in Germany. In the UK, we've just passed the Digital Economy Bill, which, among other things, essentially prohibits open wireless networks. So how about limiting bad guys from using the internet? How would you stop people who were kind of bad for your business from using the internet if you were the entertainment industry? Well, they've got a solution to it. It's something called three strikes or graduated response. The hallmark of a bad idea is that it gets frequently rebranded and gets another name. So, you know, we've got three strikes, graduated response, two strikes, and so on and so forth. You know, DRM has got like 11 names. It's DRM, it's TPM, it's copy protection, it's content protection, copy prevention, and so on. It's just, you know, all these names indicate like they're the kind of that they're the pedigree of all the times they've come up with something different to see if people liked it better when they changed the name of it. So we've got all these different names for three strikes. Sometimes it's called the streamlined process. And the idea here is that if you think someone is infringing on your copyright, you make a series of complaints to their ISP. And once the ISP racks up three unsubstantiated complaints about their behavior, you cut off their internet access. Now, on the face of it, if all this was about was copyright, that wouldn't be so big a deal. But in fact, it's about a lot more than copyright. First of all, there are very few internet connections that correspond to a single person. Usually they correspond to a household. My internet connection corresponds to two because we share with our neighbors. So that's about nine people. Now, the Geneva Conventions ban collective punishment. They're generally not thought of as good policy, and that's exactly what this is. But you cut people off from a lot more when you cut people off from the internet. You cut people off from all the things that we use the internet to do. And that's a lot broader than just downloading Police Academy sequels and Britney Spears singles. We use the internet to do everything. We use it to get our education. We use it to do our jobs. We use it to participate in politics. The man sitting in the White House tonight would not be there if his supporters had not had access to the internet. And the next person and the person after that who sits in the White House will have the same situation. I dare say we will never elect another president again in this country without the support of their constituents organizing over the internet. Civic engagement on a much more minor scale is impossible without the internet. Where I live in London, local councils who are strapped for cash are scrapping all of their paper forms in favor of digital forms. It'll soon be impossible to get permission to add a shed to the back of your house or turn your garden into a driveway or vice versa if you don't have internet access. My wife works in educational television, and she's just commissioned some research that shows that if you take two council estate families, families living in subsidized housing, and that are in all other respects similar, but you give one of them internet access, that the outcomes are remarkable. The family with internet access, their kids have better nutrition, they get better grades, they are more apt to go on to tertiary education, their parents have better jobs because they can shop a broader slice of the job market more efficiently with internet access. They save money on their bills because you can pay your bills online, and it doesn't sound like much if you've got a cushy middle-class job, but when you're truly economically marginal, saving a couple of pounds per bill per month might be the difference between eating four good dinners a week and five good dinners a week. So this is what we propose to take away in the name of three strikes. This is the non-parochial face of the copy fight. It's not just a brush war over culture. This is about which families will enjoy access to the largest library ever assembled and whose kids will go to college. Now, the people who are promulgating these policies, they clearly don't intend them to apply to themselves. Edgar Bronfman Jr., one of my countrymen, I'm a Canadian. Bronfman's got a long and honorable history. His family were drug smugglers. They used to run rum into America, and they made their fortune, and they used that to buy a series of entertainment companies. These days, he's running Warner Music. Edgar was asked if his kid downloaded music, and he said, yeah, my kid was downloading music, but I made sure that he put a stop to it, and I saw that he paid the consequences. Now, 40,000 American households have essentially lost their life savings in record industry lawsuits. The last time I checked, the Bronfman family hadn't. So clearly there's different consequences for different people. I care about finding copy-friendly business models. I think that's an important, noble thing to do because, you know, it's in my self-interest. I'm in the arts. I like the idea of being able to go on contributing to my family's household income, to being able to put some money away for my kids' education and so on. But this is bigger than whether we pay artists or how we pay artists. This is about whether the values of a free society will survive into the 21st century. Whether unfettered access to knowledge, the right to work with your neighbors, the right to enter the realms of commerce or social enterprise, social mobility and political discourse will be open to one and all, or reserved to those whose modes of expression and endeavor don't inadvertently threaten Bono's ability to earn another million. Now, there's a parochial response to this, right? If you say this to the entertainment industry lobbyists, they'll say things like, well, you just want to steal. This is all just fine and fancy language for explaining how you just want to get stuff for free. You know, as you heard, I edit this website, Boing Boing, and every day for the last 10 years now, I've found interesting and cool stuff, the majority of it produced by people who have no affiliation with the entertainment industry. I like, you know, $300 million movies about robots throwing buildings at each other as much as the next guy, but if they all disappeared tomorrow, I wouldn't miss them too much because there are so much wonderful stuff out there that's being produced outside that system that I don't really worry about whether or not I can get their stuff or can't get their stuff. You know, I don't need to steal their stuff. I've got an entirely intractable problem space of totally cool junk that I can look at every day without ever having to touch Hollywood's product. They'll say the Wild West days are over. We're just civilizing the frontier, and every frontier becomes a city. And I agree. You know, this used to be the frontier. I remember when it was wilder and woolier, and every frontier does become a city. But we're not arguing about whether or not the frontier will become a city. We're arguing about whether or not the frontier is going to become a police state. Or they'll say, it's only the internet. And this is the most parochial thing of all to say. Saying it's only the internet is like saying it's only literacy, or it's only civic engagement, or it's only nutrition, or it's only education, or it's only employment, or it's only educational, environmental advocacy or political action. All of those things today are inconceivable in the absence of the internet. So the war isn't ending. It may feel like we're kind of winding down or entering some kind of long truce. It's not. It's just getting started. And as people here on the Hill, people involved in policy, you're going to be asked to choose sides. And they'll lure you in by saying that this is just about adding a dollop of control to the network, just a little. It's like being just a little bit pregnant. If you care about living in a free society, if you care about the core values of freedom and democracy, you can't be on the side of breaking the internet, of taking away anonymity, free speech, and the borderless world. So I hope you found that compelling, and you'll come onto this side of the copy fight. Thank you. Questions? Thank you.
That's going to do it for this episode. As always, I want to thank you for listening. And if you enjoy the program, please do tell a friend. Or go to the website at thecommandline.net and click on the support link for all of the ways you can help with the production of the show. If you have a question, suggestion, or correction, you can send those to feedback at thecommandline.net, or you're welcome to post a comment up on the website. If you need to communicate with me securely, you can find details of my public key pairs at thecommandline.net/GNUPG-fingerprints. If you're away from your computer and the internet at the moment, call the listener comment line at area code 240-949-2638. The next show should go out in the feed Monday, as Sunday is a holiday here in the U.S., and I have plans to spend some downtime with family and friends and recharge the batteries a bit. I'm not 100% that the show will go out on Monday. I'm optimistic that it will. Either way, I'll either talk to you on Monday or the following Wednesday with the next feature. So until then, don't forget to hack your world. I would like to thank Liberated Syndication and Wouta DB for media hosting and bandwidth. This show is made from 100% recycled bits. Permission to recycle those further, except where noted, is granted under a Creative Commons Attribution ShareAlike 3.0 United States license. That means you can do what you like with the content as long as you tell folks where you got it and you share your changes under the same terms.